LSU Medical School, and his talk will be on the ethics of meat consumption. And let me just bring that up. And let me transfer this to you.
Cool, thank you. Thank you. I'll try to talk fast, because I think my talk actually illustrates a lot of what Johnny was trying to do, because a lot of the science that has gone on, or supposed science, that has gone on regarding meat consumption is some science there, but what does it tell us and how should we act? That's the question. And let me see if I can figure out how to do this. Yes. For those who are from California that have heard about Proposition 2, this was a big deal for California. What it essentially did was vote that animals had to have a certain bigger piece of real estate within the barns, and that was thought to be the good thing for animals. The Veterinary Association, actually, there's quite a bit of difference of opinion about this. The American Veterinary Association actually disagreed with the California Veterinary Association, but what they said is that Proposition would clearly grant greater freedom of movement, but it would likely compromise several other factors necessary to ensure the overall welfare of the animals regarding the protection from disease and injury. We are concerned with legislating isolated, arbitrary, emotionally based criteria to implement farm housing systems will actually do more harm than good for the well-being of animals, while compromising the sustainability of production systems that are essential to ensure that we continue to have the safest, most affordable, and most abundant food supply in the world. Well, there's a lot can be said about the veterinary associations and their link with the meat industry, but I don't think that you should regard this science as the final answer. There's a lot of legitimate questions that are raised about that, because what they did was, by expanding and allowing animals more access, there's a danger that they will be exposed to, particularly if they're allowed to go outside, there'd be more dangers of their disease and other issues that they brought up. Well, what are the most egregious examples of animal abuse? And I think that some of these have been taken care of by just political statements. The force feeding of geese to produce this fatty liver, which is a French delicacy. How many of you guys eat that? No. Yeah. Well, fortunately, I think Chicago has an ordinance against it now. When people found out what was actually happening to the...
Yeah.
Veal animals were raised, actually, I see what happens. This thing moves. Veal was raised in the, I'm not so used to fancy systems like this, huh? Calves were raised in these small pens because the meat was more delicate if they didn't go out, and they were intentionally deprived of iron, so they get this nice white. There's been a lot of movements for people not to eat veal. But that's only a small part of the whole problem with factory farming. And chickens that are raised in such confinement, pigs that don't have room to turn around, feedlots such as this, this is part of how we got greater efficiency. But at what price has this been to the animals? One of the problems that we in evangelicals have had is that the people who have opposed this, people such as PETA, which is the people for the ethical treatment of animals, are, first of all, they're illogical and non-scientific. They say, gee, if we just eliminate meat eating in this country, we'll have no more need for bypass surgery. Or, you know, it's just crazy statements like that. And if you go to their website, I'm not suggesting that you do, but there's some near pornographic pictures of models who've chosen to be advocates for PETA. But there actually is some very good ethical arguments, and Matthew Scully, who is was actually a speechwriter for George Bush, has written this book called Dominion, which is very readable, and I'm sort of co-opting his arguments. The first is that justice would require that we treat equals equal. And if you have a dog, and, you know, we have these affections towards animals, now I have to say that I grew up on a farm, so I have some personal knowledge of all this. We grew pigs, we grew our own beef. I knew when we were eating the cow named Susie, you know, that was what we grew up with, that, which is not much feasible anymore. But dogs and pigs are equally sentient. They have the same ability to sense these emotions. So if we wouldn't treat a dog this cruelly and leave them in a confined environment all their life, we shouldn't treat pigs that way either. We also have the concept that the punishment of certain degradation of animals is a punishable offense. And we can only go to the famous Michael Vick and his using dogs. We think that's awful. Louisiana finally banned, I think a couple of years ago, the use of cockfighting, where they would put these sharp objects on the cock's legs, and they would go at each other, and there was usually gambling going along with it as well, until they would fight to death. Such cruelty to animals, we regard it as not right. I think that's and we regard those who rescue animals and who take the eagle that has a broken leg and nurse it back to life, that's good. So that ethical argument, the greatest cruelty we have is that to farm animals. Scully describes the way pigs are raised, for those of you who are not aware of this, on a factory farm. For piglets, it's a regime of teat-tutting. They have to cut their teeth so they can't bite each other. Tail docking, performed with pliers to heighten the pain of tail chewing, so that to deter this natural tendency to this type of response in mice, mass confinement and other mutations. After 5 or 6 months trapped in one of the most grim warehouses that now pass for barns, they're trucked off 350,000 plus pigs every day in the life of America for processing at a furious pace of thousands per hour by immigrants who use earplugs to muffle the screams. But most of them have all been treated with growth hormones as well. All these creatures and billions more across the world grow to their death, not knowing nothing of life and nothing of man except the foul, tortured existence of the factory farm, never having been outdoors. So think about that next time you have bacon. The true sense of dominion and mutuality between the species is kind of the last thing that I think we would regard as a Christian ethical principle. The Pope, before he was the Pope, has a statement that's been quoted: while it's licit for us to use them, that is animals, for food, we cannot do whatever we want to them. Certainly a sort of industrial use of creatures so that geese get fed in such a way as to produce as large a liver as possible, or hens live so packed together that they become just caricatures of birds. This degrading way of living creatures to a commodity seems to me a fact to contradict the relationship of mutuality that comes across in the Bible. So I think we would agree with that. I mean, just to say that we, if we are going to use an animal, why wouldn't we want, and we're going to eat an animal, why wouldn't we want them to at least enjoy and benefit from that animal, to enjoy at least the best life possible, although their life would be short? Proverbs 12:10 is the most direct verse that speaks to that. The godly are concerned for the welfare of the animals, but even the kindness of the wicked is cruel. Now, we become so dissociated from animals that becomes difficult to do. But the animal that is your food on your table is the issue at hand. Well, shifting, I want to talk about the environment, but and I hope I have time to do that. I want to talk briefly about health, which is probably the area that I have some expertise at least on. And in the abstract, I mentioned it, but actually there's much better data now. There was a study that came out in March of this year that was published, and it was a National Institute of Health AARP study of over 500,000 people. They were aged 50 to 71 at the time of recruitment. They were followed for 10 years, and they came from those states and from the metro areas of Atlanta and Detroit. And they filled out a diary of their amount of foods they ate, including the amount of meat that they consumed, processed meat, red meat, white meat. And basically what they found, and this is a graph that kind of shows it best, is that these are the different quintiles of meat consumption. And by the way, the highest quintile takes six times as much, in this case, processed meat, as the lowest quintile. And this is strict mortality. And you can see that over this period of time, those who had the highest consumption of meat had almost twice as much, were almost twice as likely to die. And it's actually very interesting because all of the graphs look just about this way. And not, I shouldn't say that. For white meat, there's a slight negative correlation. But for red meat and for processed meat, there is this correlation. Unfortunately, there's confounders. It's interesting that those who eat a lot of meat are also likely to be smokers, have a higher body mass index and a higher energy intake. Both of which are, you know, these are things that are actually associated with increased mortality also. Higher total fat and saturated fat intake, lower educational level, less physical activity, lower fruit, vegetable, and fiber intake, all of which may be negative factors on mortality as well. The only thing that they had positive going for them that they were more likely to be married and more likely to be white or non-Asian white. When you actually correct for all those things, it sort of get to this kind of a statistic comparing. It's about 1.3 times the mortality rate after you correct for all those confounders. The hardest one to correct for was smoking, and they go into quite detail about that. If you look at it, it deals both with cardiovascular risk and with, and this is the meat intake, and this is these are the ratios, the mortality between the highest quintile, which is takes about six times as much meat as the lowest quintile. And you look at the red meat mortality, it's consistent across. It's these low confidence intervals that reflect the fact that you have 300,000 in each group. So processed meat, again, there's a pretty clear difference. It's also true of cancer, perhaps not as much as it is for the cardiovascular death risk, but pretty clear statistics across that there is some increase. Now, that's not going to blow you away, but there is probably some value in eating a lower content of a meat diet. Well, what is the cancer risk? And this is a summary of all the cancer risks from a review that was published in Europe. Most of the cancer risks, and this is a fairly convincing increased risk, comes in terms of increased risk of colon cancer. And as I say, a lot of the cancer risk also comes from crowding out. If you eat a lot of meat, you don't need a lot of vegetables and fruit, which probably have some protection against a variety of cancers. So just to look quickly, the American Heart Association suggested prudent diet, which I would have used if I hadn't had this study, suggests that you limit your saturated fat to less than 7% of energy and limit your cholesterol. These are almost taken verbatim from it. Replace meats with beans, soy, nuts, or fish. I happen to love nuts. That some people say that's natural. You minimize your intake of alcoholic beverages and fruits with added sugars, and choose for salt, particularly for the hypertensive. If you do take alcohol, do so in moderation. And when you're consuming food outside the home, the recommended entrees are fish and chicken instead of beef. Interestingly, fish in itself, they recommend 2 to 3 servings of fish per week, but actually most of the statistics will show you that even if you eat more fish a week, up to 7 or 8 servings a week, your cardiovascular mortality at least is reduced. And that's due to a couple of reasons. One is that the omega-3 fatty acids have effect on platelets. It also tends to reduce and replace animal fats. And interestingly, there's an antiarrhythmic effect that seems to come from fish oil as well. But that sort of talks about the health risks. And I think what I didn't tell you is that the American Cancer Society prevention diet is almost essentially the same as the American Heart Association prevention diet. Let's talk quickly about the myths regarding environmental impact of meat on. And one of the problems is sorting through all the science. And I have to confess that I didn't get this paper done quickly enough to get Joe Sheldon or my colleague Steve Hall to go over some of that, who are better idea, know more about the environmental risk. But there's lots of non-science floats around in the literature. Like there's this statement that gets quoted many times that 100,000 liters of water are necessary to produce a kilogram of beef. And actually, that's a very specific study if you go way back. But it gets repeated again and again, like this is the big thing. In actual fact, if you look at how much it takes, it does take quite a bit of water to make a pound of beef on average in the United States. But it's not way out of line compared to what it takes to make a kilogram of potatoes or wheat. The issue is that we in America are the issue, in a sense. We're not the only issue, and part of the issue is the future itself, but we are the biggest meat consumers, and over the course of my lifetime, at least, the average meat consumption in this country has doubled. I can remember when it was a special occasion to go out and kill a rooster and have chicken. Now, if you don't have chicken fingers for lunch and you feel like you've been deprived if you don't have meat three times a day, although a lot of what we call meat in the at breakfast, such as bacon, is actually classified as a fat. Anyway, let's not get too hung up on those details, but you can look across the world, and the problem is the future. If we continue that the developing world, particularly the BRIC nations such as Brazil and China and India, to a lesser extent, are transitioning to a higher and higher percentage of meat. And the problem is this leads to an unsustainable agriculture. This is quoted again and again. It takes about 10 times as much farmland to produce a pound of animal protein compared to what it produces a pound of plant protein. So if everyone increases it, we're going to have to find a way to get more beef. And one of the things that has happened already, and this is since 1961, is that as cattle production has gone up, pasture area has gone up, and what they've done in Central America is cut down more trees. China used to be a net producer of soybeans and exporter. Now they're an importer, and guess where they're getting it from? Brazil. And where is Brazil getting it from? They're cutting down the forest to grow soybeans to ship to China so they can grow more. They eat primarily chicken and pork. So what is the animal consumption? What are the problems with it? And how does it contribute to global warming, which is one of the other issues? First is through deforestation. And secondly, interestingly, through manure. Manure actually produces nitrates and ammonia. And if anyone's been around manure a lot like I have, it smells bad. And it also produces methane. And people are actually trying to capture methane from manure for, you know, renewable energy. It also, they have the habit of, as ruminants eat, particularly when they graze in the pasture, they eat and then they burp up methane, which as a as a global warming, both methane and ammonia are much more potent. They don't last as long as carbon dioxide, but they are more potent greenhouse gases. So if you look at it, cattle are really the worst offenders in terms of carbon dioxide production, methane production from their manure and from this enteric circulation. You get down, poultry is least, and then the smaller ruminants are somewhere in between. The big problem also is the excessive manure pollutes the groundwater. We all know about this. Thank you. This is where I live. Thank you, Midwest. Actually, the Gulf dead zone has got a little bit smaller this year, and Steve, who's an expert in that, can probably answer the question as to why it happens. But In any case, that's a big problem. And why do we have that? It's estimated that livestock in America are responsible for 55% of the erosion, 37% of the pesticides, 50% of the antibiotics, 32% of the nitrogen load, and 33% of the phosphate load into freshwater sources. The problem is what happens to what happened last year when petroleum prices went up and the cost of commodities went up. Remember when grain prices went up and everything else? That doesn't hurt us. We're rich. We can afford it. It hurts the people who live on those grains, the people who live on rice and wheat. Those are the people that are potentially going to starve. And whether you believe in biofuels or not, the estimated increase in cost of commodities was only 21%. The near doubling of it was due to the artificial rise in petroleum. But in any case, what happens is that the poor people starve, and we just have to eat less meat. I mean, that's the problem, is that the commodities really hurt the poor people the most. This is a cartoon that was published in Lancet last year, which looked at the effect of global warming in terms of what has already happened between 1970 and 2000 in terms of deaths attributed to it. And unfortunately, sub-Saharan Africa and India, to a lesser extent, are the big people that suffer. So I think there's actually an interesting congruity of science. I'm always looking for these things. Beef cattle, you go down the list, and actually it goes very, very well. I mean, the greater the health risk that comes from eating red meat, the greater environmental problems come more from, again, eating higher up there. And actually, these animals are also the most sentient. I mean, those are the ones, if you've ever seen a chicken, they're not too bright. I mean, how much they certainly have the ability to enjoy stuff. I love to see chickens being able to go outside and be able to, you know, peck around the ground. And the way we raised chickens, they had plenty of room to move around. And then there are a few exceptions. If you've been to Mongolia, where they grow their beef is completely range-fed compared to where we have it in the States, actually because the grain that's fed as they finish up is actually more efficient, there's actually less belching of methane compared to the range-fed, and actually the range-fed probably do more environmental harm. But that's kind of a limited thing. I'd rather still see the cattle being able to run freely. So what will it do and what will it cost us? It's sort of a practical issue. My son loves milk, my oldest son. And I tried to tell him about, do you really want your cows to all have recombinant bovine growth hormone? That's not given outside of this country. but recombinant growth hormone, when given to cattle, given to cows, after they, during their milk, it prevents apoptosis, which means that their mammary cells continue to secrete more milk, and during that phase of the cycle, they can produce 4 to 6 pounds more of milk a day. So if you don't add that, it means that milk is more costly. So every time I go to the store, we actually have a dairy that doesn't use it, so I always end up paying $1.50 is generous. Sometimes it's $2 a gallon more for the locally one that doesn't promise that. So those are real choices. If you had the chance, and maybe some of you live in an area of a country where you can buy humanely raised beef that are range-fed and stuff like that, that's going to cost several dollars more a pound. Are you willing to pay that? Well, what do we do? And maybe if I spoke fast enough, we'll have a chance to discuss some of these issues. Personally, I think what I've tried to do is I try to eat more simply. I try to eat smaller meat portions and sizes and eat more fruits and vegetables. Nothing wrong with that. It may help me live longer. And secondly, how are we going to influence culture? Because that's not going to stop industrial farming and factory farms. Hopefully we can accept by some example in education, which is part of what I'm trying to do today, so I've discharged that duty. But you all have people that you can influence as well, and to think about those issues and to get it out into the evangelical community. Maybe we should have a potluck where we don't have any meat. Huh? That would be different, wouldn't it? Secondly, legislative, that's the only way we're going to see these things. There was an act for humane treatment of animals that was before Congress. It didn't pass. That, to me, is just a little bit too hard. I don't know how much it is. But we do have some history behind us. You know, Wilberforce and Broome, the people who did the slave thing, and also passed a bill regarding the ill treatment of cattle in 1822, and they actually were able to change the way cattle were treated in England at the same time. So I think it is something that we can believe in and we can stand for if the legislation is properly written. I want to stop and ask for questions and discussion. John, all right. Well, I think your hand was up first.
Are you familiar with a book by, I think it's by Colin Campbell, it's called The China Study?
No, but somebody was telling me about that, I think. Yeah.
He's a nutritionist, and he studied about probably several hundred thousand people, primarily in China. And he's found a direct correlation with meat consumption and a whole bunch of diseases, including various cancers.
Sure.
And it's about it hasn't convinced me to totally cut out meat, but I have mostly cut meat out of my diet.
Yeah. The NIH AARP study is still the best one, which has just come out, and of course it's based on somebody's diary, 10 years ago. But it applies to many of us, and I think it does bolster that claim considerably. I think you can't say that there's going to be no disease if you don't eat meat. I mean, that's crazy. You're going to die of something. But it looks like the cancer risk is mostly in colon cancer. That's from another study which summarized all the cancer risks as they have tried to look at environmental factors very carefully. Somebody else was... Yes. I would say that that's more a cultural issue. I think we as a culture have accepted the fact that, cheap efficiency, lowest cost, lowest price, and we'll accept a lot of harm to animals, which we don't, as long as we don't see it. And I think that's why you can't get in to take pictures of factory farms. They just won't do it. Jack? You would have less. Certainly,
how far down can you go?
I don't know about that, but I think it was an interesting correlation. Now that's just my own way of looking at it. So you're better off to eat, and actually the environmental impact is less. Although there's some concern about fisheries and being overfished and things like this, which is another whole other issue. But
yeah.
You choose.
Well, Jennifer had her hand up earlier.
Well, I was just wondering how we... I grew up on a family cattle ranch, and our cows had, relatively good lives. They had, pastures. And,
right.
And I was able to see that these are truly sentient creatures, especially the mother calf bond or something.
Yes, yeah.
Out of mind, that the vast majority of animals that we end up eating
factory farms and with massive confinement, and there is just no knowledge of just the average person about where their food came from, when they ordered a hamburger from McDonald's, or when they, you know, what the animal go through, and the horrible stories of slaughterhouses too, of how many, you know, some percentage of these animals are still fully sentient when they go through the slaughtering process and get their skin stripped off of them and thrown in the boiling pot. How do we, you know, surely God is grieved by this.
Mm-hmm.
We read the scriptures, and God, most of the scriptures about animals are not about us eating them. They're about how God cares for the sparrow, how God brings food for the animals, although some of that food is together, but how God, you know, cares for the living creatures, and yet it's out of sight, out of mind for most of us. And so I'm just wondering how, you know, Christians are supposed to be people of compassion. How do we get the word out to people that animals are suffering right now, and there may be simple things that can be done to alleviate that?
I think it'll be tough. I think it's going to be a lot of political will, because the lobbyists are going to be there in Washington. They're going to say, you know, you don't want this, and you don't want Americans to have to pay more for food, do you? You know, and at a time when they're really already suffering, you know, to make them pay $2 more a gallon for milk or something like that. These are tough political questions, but
dairy farmers are going under.
Yeah. Well, they're getting bigger. They're getting bigger, as I understand it. I'm sorry.
No. Let's thank our speaker.
Oh, yeah, sorry.